Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be meeting John Harris Dunning, journalist and comics writer, to discuss his new work, Tumult.
We'll also be keeping things comic, stand-up comedy and more with Journey Gunderson. She's director of the National Comedy Centre, a new $50 million museum in the US created just for a laugh.
And 10 years on from the film that reshaped the modern superhero epic, we'll be discussing the impact of Christopher Nolan's film The Dark Knight with its production designer Nathan Crowley.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
What a week it's been, Tom. Have you been kind of strung out by the heat? Are you kind of, we had a little moment last week where there was a blip. It rained. It was weird, wasn't it?
It confused me profoundly.
It was a bit weird. And then we're back into the kind of heat wave. Is it taking on a monotonous kind of aspect?
I love the heat.
Yeah.
I love the sun. And I'm quite angered by people complaining about it.
Yeah.
Having said that, it does have moments where even my love of it is stretched. Namely, on the Victoria line. Or even in Monocle Towers, Midori House, it can get a little stuffy by, say, the middle of the afternoon. But I'm not going to complain.
Yeah.
But keep it coming.
Okay. But who'd we turn to for next week's events?
You know who it is. There was something in the air that night. The stars were
bright. Fernando. They were. How about some tango, guys?
Okay.
I wouldn't, you know, if I go dancing tango, I wouldn't go dressed like this. In that case, I think trousers are kind of essential. And I say this because the Mundial de Tango starts on Thursday in Buenos Aires, of course. So it's like a two-week extravaganza in the city, you know, there's all sorts of events. And this is very important. I think it's one of the most kind of important events in the tourism industry in the country. And I was checking about the list of winners in previous years. You know, it's not all Argentinians. Only last year we had a Japanese dancer. I think after Argentina, Japan is the biggest
big tango
country.
Yeah.
And Uruguay as well. Brazil doesn't do very well.
Well, I was going to ask, what's the view? Because there's obviously a sort of historic rivalry, sometimes enmity between the two. Do Brazilians?
I think we like to see when we go to Buenos Aires, but yeah, maybe we don't have that kind of dramatic style of dance. I think we generally prefer a little bit of samba. And there's a difference between tango, which I found out in this competition. There is the stage tango, which is kind of the flashy, dramatic, almost theater-like, and the other one called Salon, which is kind of the more day-to-day, a little bit more kind of subdued. And they have a winner for different categories as well.
I'd like to win the subdued tango.
I like the day-to-day tango. Day-to-day tango.
Which is
like everyday drinking.
Yeah, I think it's even sexier, the day-to-day.
You know,
it's kind of very intimate.
Well, it's something you can do while you're kind of getting dressed to go for a party. You've got a gin and tonic on the dressing table. You've got some quite good music on. That's how I kind of feel like it would be kind of nice, a preparatory thing to an evening on the tiles. A bit of day-to-day, subdued day-to-day tango.
Exactly.
What do you think about the tango? Do you, as a proud Brazilian, do you spit in its general direction, or do you love it?
No, listen, I'm not gonna lie here. I don't love it, but I admire. You know, it is beautiful when you see, you know, a beautiful tango dance.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
So it's like ballet. It's something that I don't do very often, but you know, when I see it, it's like, wow, it is impressive, and I think it's very important for Argentinians.
Do you sort of sashay? What are the doing words associated with tango? Obviously, you do tangoing, right? It's a verb in itself.
Yeah, I don't know what the moves sort of, within it are.
Yeah. Any advance, Fernando? I don't know.
Listen, I never danced tango before in my life, but I think you do need to have quite a lot of classes before you even try out.
Okay.
Especially in the Mundial de Tango, Tom.
Also, shoes would you wear? You sort of wear a kind of light leather-soled shoe. You need to have a bit of
I don't know.
A supple. I was thinking you can't do it. Like,
I think
you can do it in shorts. You can't do it in sneakers.
You don't need
sneakers.
A sort of clip-cloppy shoe, do you? Is that
they're quite
like
strict?
A tap shoe.
Is there a bit of an accent sound that goes with it, or is that
anathema?
Should it be done in? Should it be silently? I don't.
Yeah,
I think they can be quite strict with the attire as well.
Okay.
So you know, you need to kind of conform.
You need a sort of fair of high waist. I feel like almost like
high waist.
Sort of,
yes,
it's a little bit
yes.
like a sort of a matador's outfit. You need a high waist. You need a bit of arse on show. You need to. No, but you need to show a bit of waist. It needs to be quite classical so that you hold yourself correctly. I think
that's
right?
always very nice.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
And I also like, you know what? I'm not going to tell you guys, but let's hear. We have a clip for it, and then we can discuss about it.
A megalodon.
A massive prehistoric killing machine.
So glad I'm not crazy.
The megalodon was the largest shark that ever existed. It feared nothing. So what now?
We kill it.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah, you know.
Wow.
We're talking about silly season. Come on, what's the silliest thing? A gigantic shark in the cinemas.
Absolutely brilliant.
And what I like about this film, The Meg, which is with Jason Statham as a lead role, is that they spend $150 million because we're having this trend, you know, with Sharknado. Let's do cheap, fun shark movies. I mean, this is fun, but this is certainly not cheap. And they want, you know, the international markets. There's quite an international cast, a lot of Chinese actors in it as well. And I mean, we all love shark films. Don't we?
I do love shark films, but I'm exceptionally suggestible. I cry in films where you're meant to cry. I kind of like scream out at frightening films, all the rest of it. So I've always kind of, you know, I'm a bit of a behind the sofa watcher. Although next week we're going to go and watch it together, aren't we, Fernando?
Absolutely. Yeah. At a Lido, apparently, as well.
What about you, Tommy? You kind of, do you, every time you kind of go swimming and you feel something touch your leg, do you screech out?
Well, no, this is what I was going to say. So I don't like swimming in a municipal, any sort of municipal facility or bath, anything like that. Open water, love it, the sea.
Yeah.
And I must admit, just from having watched Jaws, you know, in the 1980s, I get that.
Yeah.
Da-da.
Yeah, I get that as well.
Yeah, and you can't help yourself. Yeah, is it a shadow?
Yeah.
What is that down there? You know,
it's tough, isn't it?
It's powerful. What's the deal with the Meg? Has he survived throughout history?
It's the Megalodon, you know.
And he just turns up again one day.
He's a prehistoric shark.
Or he's been knocking around the whole time.
He's been knocking around all the time, but he was hidden, you know. This ocean's quite big, Tom.
It is, I have heard that.
So I don't know how he's awakened. I have to.
And he's just like, right, I'm back, and I really want to eat Jason Statham. Is that
Yeah, and of course, I'm sure he'll pack a few punches in the shark. And,
yeah.
And guys,
I like how amazingly camp just the trailer is. Yeah. That's wonderful.
And as a matter of public service, I'd like to recommend a shark film for the listeners for the weekend.
Yeah.
It's a not very well-known shark film from Australia. It's called Bait. You know, Australia is hit by a giant tsunami. A lot of people, they get stranded in a supermarket full of water, so they're on the top of the shelves. And a shark managed to get inside the supermarket. You're laughing at it, but it's excellent.
That sounds really good. Sounds weird and Ballardian.
Yeah.
Like that. I think that sounds excellent.
It's called Bait. It's my tip. Before you see The Meg, maybe go and watch Bait.
I'll prepare myself with that. I shall spend half my weekend behind the sofa. Sounds great.
Perfect.
Fernando, thank you so much for another wonderful news look ahead. Later, we'll hear how superheroes have come to dominate the box office, but first we'll take a look at comics, where they're no longer the driving force they once were. With a graphic novel on the long list of the prestigious Man Booker Prize for the first time this year, it's fair to say that the medium has expanded beyond the realm of men in tights and into something altogether more serious.
John Harris Dunning is a connoisseur of the comic, having co-curated an exhibition of the medium at the British Library back in 2014. He's also a writer, and his last graphic novel, Salem Brownstone, attracted widespread acclaim.
His new book, Tumult, draws on a grand tradition of psychological thrillers to spin a compelling tale. And John is with us now. Thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
On Tumult. Give us a bit of a pressy, if you will, of what happens. It's a bit of a Love's Labour's Lost, or it's a bit of a heartbreaker, at least to begin with.
I mean, I could go on all day about this, but to try and make it a pricey, for me, it started off with two ideas. The one thing was, I tombstoned and I jumped off a rock and broke my ankle and messed up my spine. And that was kind of a big shock. I'd never had anything wrong with me. I'd never had a sprained ankle. And suddenly that took a couple of years to recover from. So then I started examining, I was 35 at the time, and I started sort of looking at mortality and having a midlife crisis essentially really young. So that started sort of making me question myself. And then that took me into the idea of questioning what it is to be a man, what it is to be strong, all of those things. So I really kind of extrapolated this out to a really sort of extreme point with a story, you know, and you'll see it with things like the main character's best friend, who's writing this book on man movies, all about action films and the meanings of action films and how we kind of derive images of manhood from these films. So that was the one inspiration. But then the other inspiration was David Lynch, who, you know, I really adore as an artist and have over the decades. He did what some people would think is an unwatchable piece of tosh, which is one of my favorite films, Inland Empire, which is 3 hours shot on a handy cam with no sort of script that one can really identify. I loved it. And when he tried to explain this indescribable film, he said, it's about a woman in trouble. And that goes back to the classic film noir trope. It goes back to Twin Peaks, which he based on Marilyn Monroe's life. He was writing a film about Marilyn Monroe, which was unfilmable, and he then made Twin Peaks from that. So I had these two ideas of kind of midlife crisis, analyzing, you know, masculinity, and then a woman in trouble. And honestly, that's where I started from, and then just went from there.
When you write stories, or when you were thinking about this story, did you see it in a more cinematic way, a more visual way perhaps than other work you'd done before? And is that how Tumult comes about? Do you always see it in pictures and then the words come? I mean, it's a stupid question. It's a bit facile in a way, but I'm interested in that process.
It's not at all. And it's a really good question. And I guess it's also valid for filmmakers as well. I went to film school and that's what I studied, but I was obsessed with comics as a child and I was actually quite a late prose reader. And my sister is a very, very smart lady and she was reading very, very early. I was sort of reading Super Friends and Wonder Woman and stuff, still love those. But comics really got me into reading, which is, I think, quite a common story for a lot of boys. So I always had this very strong kind of visual sense, but I also write prose as well. I've just finished a novel now, which is sitting with my agent. So I also love prose. And in fact, I was looking back at old notebooks and I found a notebook that was the beginning of Tumult as prose. And I just started writing it like that, but I started to have these really, really strong visual ideas for it. Going back to Lynch, Blue Velvet was a huge influence for me, but certainly visually I kept getting these images. And then Cindy Sherman's series, Untitled Film Stills, is something that's always interested me. And again, it feeds into this central concept, this noir concept of a woman in trouble. And what I loved about those photographs, which were shot 77 to 80 in New York, such a great moment in New York, is you see this kind of sketched out narrative that you never really understand. And Lynch also said mysteries are magnets. And there's something about this thing that if you leave gaps and you create these sort of mysterious images, really draws people in. Mm. I started to see these images, and putting the story together with these images felt like the right way to tell this particular story. So I quickly shifted out of prose and into a comic script, which I then did.
It's fascinating stuff. It's a great question. I wonder whether it works the other way around as well, whether actually being able to think in a visual way makes you ask punchy questions when you're doing prose writing, makes you write good, simple stuff. Mm. I don't mean stupid stuff. I mean really good, simple stuff. Because there's that. There's that problem of thinking you're a good writer and why use one word when 52 will do, right? And this is, and obviously writing for the graphic novel style has to be punchy. Everything has to mean something.
Sure, it's interesting because if you look at people like Neil Gaiman and Alan Moore, who are obviously incredibly well-respected comic book writers and writers in prose in other ways as well. It's interesting, Moore is known as somebody who writes the most outrageously long comic scripts. I don't know if you know that. If you look at his script for The Killing Joke, it's hilarious. I was teaching comics and I showed it to my students. The first three pages is the beginning of the first panel's description. And he's describing stuff that's not in the panel. So you're just like, what are you doing? But actually the page is completely silent. So it's that. It's that sum of writing a comic is I would put huge amounts of information into the script, but it could be a completely silent page. So it's a communication that really is in collaboration with the artist. And sometimes a lot of that writing, as you say, is not to do with the words that appear on the page. It's almost making sure that you don't have to write anything.
It's sort of set direction kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And that allows you to really strip down the captions and the dialogue in many ways.
I love the silent page. That could be a David Lynch film.
Honestly, again, that is one of the absolute central concerns I have. Is silent comics. I think it's so important to have that moment in comics that you can breathe. Mm. And it's almost the opposite of what Stan Lee and Kirby and those guys, although I absolutely love their comics, did, where you have 180 characters, 10 years happening in one page, all talking at the same time. I mean, it makes me want to have a panic attack. The Japanese, on the other hand, had this really rich, rich tradition of silent comics. And there's some amazing reprints at the moment. There's actually one called Fukashimi Death Fish, which has been released by Breakdown Press. And it's little short stories about people working in nuclear plants in Japan from post-war to now. And they are the most heartbreaking stories. And they're so good at silence and also architecture. So they'll start a scene where you're looking at a streetlight, a building, a garden, a window, and then you're inside the room and you start... You know, it's a whole page of just setting the scene. That's what the Japanese do very well. So I try to do quite a lot of that in Tumult as well. And then balance it with a story, hopefully, and a bit of narrative action. And I think that's, again, where I come back to Blue Velvet. Yeah. But one of my favorite scenes in that film, which I think is such a clever film in terms of it really drives the action. You're really into it. There's great dialogue. But there's one scene where Kyle MacLachlan's walking down the street with Laura Dern. You see them walking down the street, and then the shot is just of the trees above them passing as they talk.
Yeah.
And then they're just quiet walking in the dark. And that is such an amazing moment. And then you plunge back into the action, these characters and this dialogue. And for me, that's really key to activate the more complex sequences, is to allow the readers and the viewers to breathe slightly. Mm. It allows them to kind of almost inhabit the world more.
Tell us about that in respect of Tumult, John. Mm. How schooled in the kind of light and shade and the subtleties of graphic novels, you mentioned Fukushima Death Fish or whatever, how schooled do people have to be in the canon in order to get the most out of your book?
Absolutely not at all. I mean, I'm a huge believer in that as well. I don't think you should have to know any of this stuff. Mm. This is not an academic exercise.
It's there to discuss and to wallow in if you dig it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And actually, it's there to give a better experience. You know, it was like, you'll see there's a lot of Kurt Cobain references, which I'm constantly ripped off for in this this book. The artist said, like, he had to get into Kurt Cobain to actually draw this book. But Kurt Cobain always used to say his best band was Queen and Bon Jovi because they were entertaining the audience. It's like you hope that what you can do is elevate the material. But for me, certainly, the key thing was to actually entertain an audience, or certainly seduce an audience and give them some kind of pleasurable ride. And then do all these other trickeries and hopefully to feed into that.
You mentioned the artist, the illustrator. I don't know, again, I'm not sure on the correct labels. What's the preference
both
that you have
good.
or that Michael might have?
Yeah.
So how does that process begin then? And what's that collaboration like? Because, I don't know, I guess the dynamic in a graphic novel or in a comic is probably different to almost any other kind of collaboration, in the sense that each of the two things is parked, but they're inextricably linked. Mm. How did it begin?
You're absolutely right. It is kind of unlike anything else. I mean, if it works, it's sort of like a happy Morrissey and Johnny Marr situation, which certainly in this case it was. But it can be very unhappy as well, because the thing is, you really are both sharing the creative responsibility. So if you're on the same page, literally, excuse the pun, but it's amazing. If it doesn't, it's extremely agonizing. So what happened for this project, for instance, is I wrote the whole story and had the script and then went looking for artists. Finding that person was difficult, and it's partly to do with a graphic novel. This is 180 pages. It's between 6 and 8 panels a page. That's all those drawings plus your coloring. It takes a good year to draw, and there's very little money in it up front. So it's a very difficult thing to find somebody at a particular level who can actually take this time. So it took a long time to find the artist. But it was interesting when we did find each other. As soon as he read the script, he said yes. And then he sent some sketches, which I loved. And in fact, I was off to Angoulême, which is the Cannes Film Festival of Comics. I'd received an email from him and I hadn't responded to him. I thought I had, but I was on the train over to France and the email hadn't sent, so he hadn't heard back from me. So in his usual meticulous fashion, Michael, who's only 23, put together a 100-page mood board of images, which he then sent to me. So Monday I got back and there was this huge mood board, including colour mood boards, which you'll see is very, very important in this book. He broke the whole
thing
down
in colours. That must be quite a kind of emotional moment as well as anything else, just suddenly to see your story come back at you, 100 images, that's a big thing.
Especially because some of those images were extremely rare and unusual images, which I had personally been working from, which he couldn't have known about. So there was a real magical moment of, this guy's definitely the right artist. So from there, it was quite easy, if that makes sense. But it's not always like that.
Do you sketch yourself? Do you write with a sort of almost a storyboard in front of you? Or do you write as a play might look?
Watch out, plug. But at Orbital Comics, on the 16th of August, there's going to be an exhibition of the artwork and the sketchbooks and everything. So you'd be able to see it there in London. But also put some stuff online. It's essentially, I can see these characters perfectly. And so what I will do is, give huge amounts of research material to Mike. And so I made a little folder on a Dropbox and just downloaded hundreds of images. I've also got a real, I mean, I know this sounds dreadful, but I've got a real thing about how comic book artists draw women's clothes, because most male artists don't know how to draw women's clothes. So yeah, had this obsession about what she was wearing, her shoes.
You have to give her a wardrobe. Like,
it was ridiculous. I mean, yeah. And so, I mean, it got to the point where for one panel, where there's that one panel where you see the Wolf Department and the slumming Hollywood starlet being papped, I think I sent him 50 images of possible outfits she could be wearing, and it's only a head and shoulders picture. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I bombarded him with the stuff. He was extremely patient with me, and he allowed it. And in fact, he quite enjoyed it, because it's not prescriptive. It might sound more prescriptive than it is. It's more like saying, this is how I see it. This is the image. And then I would pull back, and he would quite often surprise me, or he would do another spin on it and make it his own. But then he knew the direction and the kind of the vision. So there was never a locking of horns, but there was a lot of downloading of ideas between us, or he would send images and sketches, and then we would kind of bat that to and fro. It's
you
one
must
of the
have
most
spoken
exciting
to him for about 12 hours a day for a year.
It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
No, we did a lot. Yeah.
John, there's some point you made about the travails of graphic novels in this country as against France or Germany or in the US, wherever it might be. Mm. What do you attribute that to? And do you think that's changing? And we spoke very briefly before we started talking about, you know, is it the moment for graphic novels? And we've got a graphic novel on the Booker long list, which has been hailed in some quarters as a sort of a breakthrough. Is there a problem with
There's a huge problem here. I mean, one of the main problems is the government's response to comics here. I mean, in Europe, and particularly I've seen it in Germany and France, I'm sure it's the same in Spain and Italy as well, there's massive government funding for comics. Now, Arts Council England were absolutely key to setting this comic up. So they were absolutely amazing. And they also helped another graphic novel, which Self-Made Hero published, called Apollo, which has just come out, which is fantastic, all about the Apollo mission. So they are doing good, but there needs to be other funds, there needs to be other support for artists. Because as I've said to you, what happens is you're spending a year and a half, even 2 years on a book, and publishers cannot hope to give you that kind of advance. So there has to be some sort of government investment. What's happened is that if you look in America, some of the most successful American artists and writers are British, mostly Scottish, actually. So you look at somebody like Frank Quitely, Grant Morrison, Warren Ellis, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Pete Milligan. I mean, these people are all Brits who are working in America because they can't work here, because they just aren't the royalties. You know, and there's been a breakdown of publications. There's no deadline. There's no crisis. These were weeklies and monthlies that were going. So people are just being headhunted and kind of brain drained straight to the US. Also, what happened was I did this exhibition at the British Library. And the reason that happened was because I discovered that people who had archives, people like Dave Gibbons and Moore and stuff, basically, I don't know what Moore was doing with his material, but certainly a lot of other artists and writers are having to give the material to collectors in Europe or America because no one here wants them particularly. So for me, a big part of that exhibition was making museums and cultural institutions aware of this wealth of comics, which are just disappearing because nobody here values them on that sort of cultural level. To be fair, the British Library absolutely came on side and did a huge amount with their archive and bringing material in and making that material available. So that has started to change. But that's where I'm saying it's extraordinary that we have this talent, and yet it's being bought, the material, overseas, and also it's being commissioned overseas. That should change.
And there's money to be made, presumably. The success of these people shows you
precisely
that. Look
at Mark Miller. I mean, yeah. Mark Miller's just, you know, sold his ideas to Netflix for maybe $100 million. This is stuff that makes money. Look at the money that Alan Moore's material has made. Look at Grant Morrison's success on Netflix. This is stuff that turns
even
money
if they
over.
Even
why?
If they don't like the real massive money generating side of it.
Yeah, totally.
They're happy with the royalty check.
Yeah, right. Completely. Well, completely. And some of them really, really do like it, you know, and have benefited very much from it. But for me, it's just, why isn't that being kind of drawn back to some kind of support and a realization that this is actually a very good breeding ground for material? In terms of what you were saying about the Booker Prize and all of those things, I do think it's a moment. My husband took a lot of convincing about comics. And what he would always say to me was he'd never read comics as a kid. And then I said, but did you read Tintin? Did you read Asterix? Oh, well, of course I did. I think people don't really make the connection between the fact that they have read comics, they understand how to read comics, but then they grow out of it and maybe they don't like superheroes and they're not into kind of big action films, whatever. They don't realize that there's a huge wealth of material and that actually if they come back to them, that they can enter it. Because as I always say, comics is a medium, not a genre. And I think people confuse that and think, actually, I don't feel like Men in Tights, you know?
John, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on Tumult. It's out now. You mentioned something orbital or global or something where some people can see some of the sort of raw artwork and stuff.
It's Orbital Comics, which is just near Leicester Square. And there's going to be an exhibition from the 16th of August onwards. It's for 2 weeks, and it is going to be the artwork from Tumult, the artist Michael Kennedy, and also artwork from the graphic novel Apollo, and that's the artist Mike Collins, and the writers Chris Baker and Matt Fitch.
Thanks again, John. And John Harris Dunning's excellent new graphic novel Tumult is out now. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Time for some music now, and here's something from the playlist that John Dunning put together as inspiration for his illustrator, Michael Kennedy. This is David Lynch and Karen O with Pinky's Dream. Pinky's Dream.
That was Pinky's Dream, David Lynch and Karen O. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Now, maintaining a sense of humour about things helps any big project along, but a new $50 million museum in Jamestown, New York State, has making people laugh at its heart.
The National Comedy Centre, which opened this week in US comedian and actress Lucille Ball's hometown, is no joke, though, incorporating elements ranging from smart technology to Seinfeld's less-than-smart ruffled shirt.
A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to the new attraction's executive director, Journey Gunderson.
The concept originated with Jamestown, New York native Lucille Ball, a beloved comedian and a formidable businesswoman at that. And it was in the late 80s that she said to the arts council of her hometown of Jamestown, when they came to her about the celebration of her legacy, she said, you know, don't just make this about me or nostalgia about I Love Lucy. Make Jamestown a destination for the celebration of all comedy and the art form of comedy in a way that would educate and foster and inspire people.
And the museum is opening this week, and you've had some top comedy talent coming through. Tell us about some of the people who are associated with this.
The grand opening of the National Comedy Center is headlined by Amy Schumer, Lily Tomlin, Dan Aykroyd, Lorraine Newman, and original Saturday Night Live writer Alan Zweibel. And so, you know, Lily Tomlin is a legend in comedy and, of course, got her start from Laugh-In, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Amy Schumer has gone from stand-up to television to film and is going to be remembered, of course, as one of the most successful artists of this era.
I've lived in New York my whole life, but they always just like assume I'm from the Midwest. I've got that look about me, right? It looks like I've milked something recently, right? I know. On the subway, I'm telling you all the time, people are always like, are you lost? I'm like, no. They're like, are you Amish? I'm like, no. I just like wearing this bonnet. Like, why are you... It's my fault I look dope in a bonnet? I don't think so.
And then to have a Saturday Night Live Originators panel discussion with the original cast members of Lorraine Newman and Dan Aykroyd, an original writing team, that's one of the few entertainment institutions, let alone a comedy institution, that can endure more than 40 years. Saturday Night Live has been an incredible part of American culture, and so it feels like a fitting tribute to comedy. We actually have a panel discussion about comedy and the First Amendment and freedom of speech, centered around the legacy of Lenny Bruce. So that features his daughter, Kitty Bruce, the comedian Louis Black, known for his angry rants, and attorney Paul Cambria, who specializes in freedom of speech.
And that's an interesting element, isn't it? There's so many different strands of comedy, but one of the strands that is maybe perhaps one of the most sort of pertinent to the things that are popular today is its ability to sometimes shock and sometimes make people rethink the way they think about things from their own lives all the way up to politics and stuff like that. I mean, are you trying to provoke people at all anywhere in the museum in that way? Or are you trying to keep this strictly family friendly? Because there's a big scope of the kinds of comedy you can show, isn't there?
You're absolutely right. And so early on in the concept and design phases, we knew that we could not be guilty of censoring the very thing we're celebrating. There was skepticism about if we were going to build a tourism attraction based on comedy, would we try to make it too family friendly? And so we have not done that. We have been pretty inclusive of content and also made a lower level of the museum called the Blue Room, which is entirely uncensored and actually celebrates the history of comedy when it comes to pushing the boundaries of freedom of speech. We talk about censorship, the history of taboo. We talk about figures like Richard Pryor, Lenny Bruce, and George Carlin, the history of roast and insult comedy. So we really are inclusive of all forms of comedy, and there's something here for everyone.
If there is a God, if there is a God, may he strike this audience dead. See, nothing happened. Nothing happened. Everybody's okay. All right, tell you what. Tell you what. I'll raise the stakes. I'll raise the stakes a little bit. If there is a God, may he strike me dead. See, nothing happened. Oh, wait, got a little cramp in my leg.
And I'm interested in some of the physical attractions on show as well, because I was reading that you have Harold Ramis's Ghostbusters costume and Jerry Seinfeld's ruffled shirt. Are there any other things in the collection which are pretty obscure, but which comedy fans would really get a kick out of seeing?
Yes. So it's a highly interactive and immersive and technologically savvy experience. It's even personalized to one's own taste in comedy by use of an RFID chip worn around each visitor's wrist. But then we annotate that experience with physical artifacts so that every visitor stands in the presence of the DNA of some of the greatest comedians of all time. You mentioned Harold Ramis and Jerry Seinfeld. We also have costumes from the Marx Brothers. We have Charlie Chaplin's cane, Phyllis Diller's dress. We have a whole display case featuring handwritten creative materials from Andy Kaufman, Joan Rivers. The list goes on and on.
I must highlight, I was reading about this, I believe there is a farting bench. Can you describe this to me, please?
I should lead with the fact that there are more than 50 exhibits on all things comedy, and some of them are, again, some of the most complex interactives at any museum anywhere. But yes, also, we have a little nod to prank humor opposite a large wall mural about the history of the art form from Shakespeare and vaudeville through today. There is one bench of the two that when you sit down on it has a whoopee cushion effect.
Have you had visitors through yet? Have you seen how that one goes down?
Yes, we did some intensive beta testing of the whole experience over the last few weeks with more than 300 beta testers. And it was very fun to see the bench in action, as well as things like the comedy continuum, which is right around the corner from the bench. That is a 70-foot wide touchscreen interface that allows for a dynamic and expansive exploration of all connections in comedy. So you are really unfolding a spider web of professional collaboration and connections of influence between artists. It's a fascinating demonstration of that 6 degrees of separation, but in comedy.
I'm interested in the sort of duality there about how comedians construct their routines, because they test jokes in small clubs if they're a big comedian, and if they fall flat, they obviously drop them and stuff. How much testing, you mentioned there about the testing the fart bench, but I mean, just in general, I mean, what's the policy? Should this museum educate or should it make you laugh? And if it doesn't make you laugh, does something get bumped out of the lineup?
That was also a challenge in the design process and something we held the bar pretty high on, which was we need to educate people and do more than just entertain. But we also said people should be laughing in every wing and gallery. And if they're not, we're doing something wrong. So versus a Hall of Fame, we have taken the approach of being more of an art museum, where what you are seeing and appreciating within our walls is really the contributions to the art form. The focus is on the bodies of work versus the level of celebrity of the creators themselves. And the feedback that we've gotten from the industry has been overwhelmingly positive as far as that approach being really the higher road and one that does and more justice to the art form itself.
And comedy is a constantly evolving thing. Are you going to be sort of trying to update it regularly? Because humour changes, doesn't it? So things that we found funny 10 years ago are either inappropriate or the execution of how the comedy is made moves on. How are you looking to sort of keep it feeling contemporary? Or is it not really about that? Is it more about the actual history of stand-up and things like that?
We are planning to keep it very up to date so that we always have our finger on the pulse of what's going on in comedy today. So as much as you're learning about Buster Keaton, you're also seeing Ali Wong in the stand-up exhibit. So we really, someone said, from Chaplin to Chappelle. And so the exhibits and the technology are designed so that they're easily updatable. There's a content management system that serves as really the nervous system of the whole attraction, and that allows us to continue to update it annually.
People praise my husband for coming to all of my doctor's appointments with me. Oh my God, I can't believe he comes to all your doctor's appointments. He is so supportive. Guess who else has to go to those doctor appointments? Me. I'm the star of the show. There's nothing for the camera to see if I'm not there. But he's the hero for playing Candy Crush while I get my blood drawn. Meanwhile, if I do mushrooms 7 months pregnant, I'm a bad mommy.
And this is a very, very niche job that you yourself have. Can you just tell us how you came into this world? I mean, have you always been a comedy fan, or were you sort of parachuted into the project and found yourself having to adapt to the ways the comedy world works? What was your background before starting this project?
Well, it was a little of both when it comes to my passion for comedy, but also needing to really learn about the art form and industry. So I was hired about 8 years ago by the board of directors. I had been consulting for the organization and come from the nonprofit world doing educational media production. So there was relevance in my background, but it was not a comedy background. And so for 8 years, I've produced the Lucille Ball Comedy Festival. And so working in comedy, that has really given me a front row seat to the unique aspects of the community of comedy, the art form itself. And thank goodness, because that heavily informed the design every step of the way. And we also formed an advisory board of comedy community members, artists and innovators and business people in comedy, again, to make sure that this attraction and this experience felt like it was of the voice of the industry. So even just as an example, the media pieces that you're seeing in the attraction, when it's commentary about the art form, it's never a voiceover of the museums. It's always the voice of an artist, because we did dozens and dozens of interviews with members of the comedy community to make sure that authenticity of voice was paramount.
Who's your favorite comedian? Who really makes you laugh, whether they're in the museum or not?
Oh, I have so many. It's such a difficult question to answer. Someone who comes to mind most immediately is Paula Poundstone. She's one of my favorites. She's a stand-up who's also known for being brilliant off the cuff and brilliant with crowd work. I'm a big fan of the movie The Ghostbusters. You mentioned that we have Egon's suit on display. But this is the kind of museum that you go through and you are reminded of all of your sort of favorite moments of all time across different genres. And so it's important to know as a visitor, you could spend days here and not see everything.
All right, I'm trying to think of what's meaningful and deep that I can leave you with. I died about 15 years ago. My heart stopped for a minute. And I can tell you this about that. There is no bright light. And there's nobody waving you anywhere. Unless, of course, there's a 1 minute waiting period that I'm not familiar with. Or unless my friends and loved ones are avoiding me even in death. Cover the light, cover the light.
And the National Comedy Center is in Jamestown, New York, and we heartily recommend you head down there for a visit.
Today, queues of superhero fans at the box office are perhaps only surpassed by the queues of superhero films and their inevitable universe-building offspring to match.
But it wasn't always the case. The long game of trying to create whole new worlds with a light sprinkling of credibility rather than just one-off cinematic events is a relatively new concept. And it could certainly be argued that Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, a reimagining of Batman with a grim tone and some brutal realism, helped to set that modern template.
The Dark Knight film is 10 years old this year, and recently Monocle's Ben Ryland met its production designer, Nathan Crowley, who's also helped create the look of such hits as Interstellar and Dunkirk. They spoke about how the Dark Knight's approach to the Caped Crusader spawned tributes, tent poles, and copycats.
Wait! Who are you?
You know who I am.
I do?
Your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
Misery, misery, misery. That's what you've chosen. I offered you friendship, and you spat in my face.
How many times has Spider-Man been adapted for the big screen? 3, maybe 4 times? The answer? 11 times. In 2018, comic book movies have carved out their very own genre, and it's a lucrative one. Since the premiere of Iron Man kicked off the Marvel Cinematic Universe in 2008, that studio has raked in more than $12 billion in box office takings. Back in 2005, however, things were a little bit different. Warner Brothers' Batman franchise had been laying dormant since 1997, when George Clooney's stint put a freeze on any future films.
All right, everyone, chill. Chill. Chill.
So when director Christopher Nolan signed on to resurrect the character, he knew he had to take things in an entirely new direction. Production designer Nathan Crowley had already worked with Nolan on the film Insomnia in 2002, but a big-budget action movie was a completely new challenge for both of them.
I know Chris had always been a fan of Batman. In fact, if you look at Memento, you can see a Batman poster as a piece of set dressing in the background there. So I think he'd always been a big fan. I think anyone sort of growing up from our generation in London, you're a fan of the Tim Burton Batman, Star Wars and James Bond. That's what you go to Leicester Square to go and see. It started early on, and I was a relatively unknown production designer. Chris was a relatively unknown, but filmmaker, but was gaining success. And he had said to me, I want to make Batman. I'm not sure, it was very difficult in those days because he wasn't sure whether he could get both his cinematographer and his production designer, whether the studio would allow those two picks because it was such a large, big budget film.
I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
Director Tim Burton had already been credited with giving Batman a darker tone, scrubbing out any memories of campy humor left over from the 1960s television series. But Burton's films, the 1989 original and its sequel, Batman Returns, had never aimed for realism. Burton had taken his cues from early German cinema. Both films have a very clear and very intentional sense of being inside a carefully constructed make-believe world. But revising that style had already taken some unfortunate turns. 1995's Batman Forever, with its glossy Art Deco and bright green paired with a garish purple, brought in some solid box office but didn't win many fans. The next installment sank the series completely. Needless to say, the stakes were high.
I think Chris's approach, or our approach, to try and this realism that we've been trying to touch upon by going into the landscape, going onto locations, feeling the weather, which we've continued taking on in all our films now. That's where it started. It was like, well, we don't necessarily want to make it solely on sound stages, and we don't really want to do the theatrical version. Our favorite films are big but scale immersive films like David Lean's. So yeah, of course you have stage bills, but we need to intermix that with locations and the reality that the location gives us. And, could this city really exist and what would it look like? So, our point of view was, we were trying to gain a new point of view, but I think, well, certainly from my point of view, the sort of naivety of why it wouldn't be popular was a little shocking when it came out and people started asking me, well, why did you make another one? And it was like, well, it's not another one. It's the first one for us.
How did it work then for you creating the look of that? Because, of course, you being the production designer of the films, You were filling some fairly big shoes left by directors like Tim Burton, who really took Batman from the realm of 60s television and made him dark and returned him to what many saw as the roots of the character. But of course, his films were very heavily influenced by German Expressionism, and they were designed to make it clear that you weren't in reality, you were in another version of a place that was very haunting and clearly inside, but it was fine because it was very cinematic and artistic, whereas your films in many ways are the polar opposite to that. You're giving it a whole new look. What was it like to approach that and just really, I suppose, just drag everything off the desk that had been there before?
It was a lot of theory. It was like, okay, if this guy really could exist in our cities, in somewhere like New York or Chicago or London, like, how does it work? Like, how does he get the car? How does he fly? How does he fight? You know, he doesn't have any superpowers. So let's try and explain and figure out visually how he manages to do everything. So, you know, the first thing was the Batmobile and the idea that Wayne Industries had a sort of military arm, which has sort of become a very realistic proposition now. And this would have been a spec car that maybe wasn't that these big companies decided not to make, like Northrop and all of these guys, but it was under wraps. So it was a sort of prototype, so he could adapt the prototype. That was one of the first things we tried to explain. So it had to be more like a military Humvee. We would mix a Lamborghini into it eventually, and it would have that technology. It was designed for the army, and therefore the first time you see it, it's in camouflage. It's in army camouflage colors. You know, and that was a fascinating thing to design. So we sort of tiptoed into the whole film. Myself and Chris start very early, just while he's sort of rewriting, he wants some visual import. So we start, before we end up with these sort of massive crews, we start very early in his house and try and tiptoe our way through the visuals of the film and where we want to go with it. Really, the Batmobile was the first thing we sort of, it's like, okay, well, let's tackle the big thing, and probably one of the design, you know, people love the Batmobile, so we have to somehow find a way through it. From that, you start saying, well, if our thing is realism and this man could really exist, then we have to apply that across the board to everything. So you have to apply that to cities, to architecture, to all his gadgets. We have to explain this one by one by one. We have to try and tackle this, and then eventually tackle his suit, which now, if we have a man running around the city in a sort of black rubber suit, we have to sort of make it okay to do that in daytime. And daytime was key for us. Like, how do we, you know, it's one thing at night when you can hide him in the shadows visually, but how do we deal with the daytime? Because it might look farcical.
Treating comic book movies seriously has, for a long time, been a tricky task in Hollywood. Way back in the 1970s, when director Richard Donner began work on the original superhero movie, Superman, starring Christopher Reeve, he was quickly frustrated by an early draft of the script that saw the Man of Steel dealing jokes in an almost pale imitation of Adam West. Wisely, Donner decided that the key to bringing a comic book hero off the page and onto the screen was living up to the promise of his film's tagline. You'll really believe a man can fly.
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me? Who's got you?
For Nathan Crowley, that meant paring things back a little. The villains, Scarecrow in the first film, played by Cillian Murphy, the Joker in The Dark Knight, a legendary performance by Heath Ledger, and Bane in The Dark Knight Rises, played by Tom Hardy, paired with Anne Hathaway as Catwoman. They'd all existed in Batman's world for decades, on the pages of comic books, in movies, and on television. The question now became, if these characters existed in our world, how might they look?
You have to find a sort of a reference that exists in our world, like the Joker was the punk, Sid Vicious and Johnny Rotten. I could believe him, you know, if I was walking up the King's Road in the 80s, I could believe that character being there, you know. So, you know, you just needed to grab hold of something that we could ground each of those characters in and each of those places in. And I think, you know, architecturally, we sort of ground ourselves into Kowloon, the walled city of Kowloon, and that reference, because it's like, it was so crazy that the architecture had grown over each other. I mean, it's been demolished some time ago now, but, and so it was like, okay, this is our reference for the Narrows. I can touch this and know that this is a future possibility.
He comes at me with the knife. Why so serious? He sticks the blade in my mouth. Let's put a smile on that face. And... why so serious?
Since his early beginnings in the late 1930s, Batman's home has been a fictional one, Gotham City. Architecturally, however, Crowley's vision of Gotham is an unmistakable blend of Chicago meets Detroit.
You know, often you're driven by tax deals, and that's what the money said to go and make it in London, and they made Tim Burton's Batman in London, so it didn't seem odd to us. But then we went to Chicago, and it was like, okay, this city has all these underground roadways, and if we could do all the stunts for real on the roads, and we could use upper whacker and lower whacker and get some of that, the danger of a fast Ronin type car chase in real streets, that would, you know, up the ante. And if we can make this car, if we can build it for real and get it up to 100 miles per hour, we only got it up to 90 miles per hour, but, you know, put a real 450 Chevy engine in it and really push that realism, then that would be fantastic. So when Batman Begins in Chicago, we sort of discovered our love of going to locations. And I think Chris has never actually said this is, I suspect the reason we burnt everything down at the end of Batman Begins, like we burnt Wayne Manor down, therefore the Batcave's gone, and therefore his mansion's gone. We destroyed everything. So therefore Dark Knight could be a city film. And I think when we've gone to Chicago, because we made Dark Knight primarily in Chicago, it was like, okay, this is the launch pad for who he might become. And then we could really go towards a sort of almost modernist city councils, you know, that whole sort of modernist federalism building, or federal building, modern 60s federal building. We could now play Gotham in that place, and the fact that we've destroyed everything through the story of Batman Begins gives us a fresh start.
10 years on from The Dark Knight, its legacy is a complicated one, a perfectly paced story threaded with complex moral themes, coupled with a brilliant performance from Heath Ledger shortly before his tragic death, quickly gave the film legendary, even classic, status. And like Star Wars or The Godfather, it's a trilogy that will be rewatched by generations to come. But just as Batman's arrival in Gotham City spawned costumed criminal copycats, the success of the films led to many others trying to emulate its darkness. And in the age of DC and Marvel universes, the idea of a trilogy of connected films seems perfectly quaint. Nathan Crowley's Batman was the perfect fit for Christopher Nolan's vision of the character, but stories are unique and individual, and he cautions against applying that template to other superhero stories, as DC has tried to do with characters such as Superman.
I think it'd be very hard to actually work on another superhero film for me, and mainly because I've moved past that. I mean, I think we have to as you make, more and more immersive, complex films with someone like Chris Nolan, I feel like you go on that journey with the film and you gain knowledge and you take it to the next film. And I don't think I could ever go back to that genre just because I feel like we've done it. And what we've learned from it is sort of unapplicable to any other superhero film. We have to apply it to films like Interstellar, which there's no way we could have made Interstellar without having done the Batman films and learnt from how you make grand scale films. And so back to your question, I think every film, every story, every script has to be its own thing, in my opinion. So there's no point in touching old ground. You have to find a new ground, because Superman does have superpowers, Batman does not. So you have to sort of, I liked what they did with the first Superman film, where they treat it as more as an alien invasion film, which I thought was you know, the recent Superman films, which I thought was very clever.
Batman is once again said to sweep across the screen in a solo film. It's unclear if Ben Affleck will revive his role that's previously been met with some, shall we say, mixed reviews. Director Matt Reeve says the script will most likely take its cues from classic noir, a return perhaps to Batman's days as the world's greatest detective. Since it was created by Bob Kane and Bill Finger in 1939, Batman has been reinvented and reinterpreted for every decade, for children and for adults. The character has become a staple of modern mythology, allowing us to live out heroic fantasies and tackle complex political issues and moral questions. Nolan's trilogy may be the perfect execution of its source material, but as anyone who's ever read a comic book will know, there's always another story to be told. For Monocle, I'm Ben Rylan.
Edition 474 of the Monocle Weekly, Tom. I thoroughly enjoyed today's programme. I think Fernando's knocking it out of the park on the news look ahead.
Absolutely love
stakes
that.
At the moment, right?
And there's been a sort of a tango spirit in the air ever since sashayed into Studio
sashayed
One.
Sashayed out, high-waisted trouser, short with a slit.
Should we try tango? That's the question.
What?
You've probably done tangoing, haven't you? I just imagine that you might have done
I did
at some
do
point.
It. I have
you
done
have
it.
Done?
Yeah.
Does it agree with you?
I'm not very good at learning steps.
Generally, as I understand it, important in doing dancing.
Do you know what I mean? It's like I quite like a bit of rhythm. I like a dance, but I'm deeply lazy. It's freestyle.
Don't
always.
Trammel my style.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you have to sort of do this, and it's all quite mathematical. But it's beautiful
it's
when done correctly.
It's very serious business, though. It always seems to me, perhaps over serious by some of its practitioners.
It's a bit like the serious business of comedy, right?
Indeed.
You kind of think that it's all kind of natural verve and vitality and warmth and vigour, and it's a little bit tick. But hey, it's for better men than me.
that's potentially true. I don't
that's
know.
Basically true, isn't it?
Tell you who I did like talking to.
Yeah.
John Harris Dunning.
Isn't he great? I really enjoyed
guy.
Him. What a good talker about us. Most people that come in on this programme are very good at the thing that they've come in to talk about. Obviously, it should go without saying. But he was a real kind of font of information, wasn't he?
And it's a luminous project, the new book, Tumult. Heartily recommended to our listeners.
Yeah, it's amazing. Shall we thank our pals behind the glass? Today's show was produced by Augustin Macellari and Tom Hall, and our studio managers were Sarah Miles and George McDonough. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.